It's the bearded one.
How you doing, Mike? I don't require that anybody use the formal title of bearded one. That's okay.
I don't know if you remember Matt from the conference last year. He was kind of hanging around.
Hi there.
Hello.
Wow.
That was like loud, Chris.
Patience is a virtue, man.
And old Chris, he's our...
Not right now, it isn't.
Wow. Yeah.
Shut up.
How long do you have this evening?
Oh, I'm good. You're good? I'm good to go. I've already opened a beer, so I'm set.
Oh my God. No, I really don't like him.
Well, you're going to have to tell us what beer you're drinking now.
Leinenkugel's Oktoberfest.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a sucker for a seasonal beer because you can't get them all the time.
That's so right.
You do.
Do you like the Saranac and Samuel Adams samplers?
Yeah, I love a sampler.
Yeah,
you find new things that way.
That's what we got last time. Wasn't the Sam Adams sampler?
Was it Sam?
Yeah, but they've always got a seasonal beer.
No, it was the Bock, because it has the who makes Amber Bock or not Amber Bock?
Remember.
I was gonna say I think Amber Bock.
I
is
drank
Michelob.
Too much that night.
It is.
I can't remember.
God, what was that sampler bought over Dodge City Days that I bought? Because I brought you.
We had some mead that evening.
Boston. It had a Boston Lager in it.
No, that's Sam Adams. It wasn't Boston Lagers. It was, dang it. It drove me nuts. No much good liquor store.
Yeah, because you go there so often.
And welcome to another edition of Comic Pock Visits. In this episode, we're visiting with C. Michael Hall. He's the author of Helldorado, an Ape Entertainment graphic novel, as well as other graphic novels we'll get into. He also has the distinct pleasure of being a librarian. So, Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
On the Helldorado, were you the actual writer or were you actually the creator as well?
It was something that I wrote and I created. I have a co-creator credited on that book. That's Brent Irwin, who's one of the owners of Ape Entertainment. And Brent called me on the phone, had a one-sentence description, said, I want to do a Western in a town that gets attacked by vampires. Go write that for me. And that was literally all I got from him. And the series came out of that. And because I find vampires really boring, I said, can they be Chinese vampires? And he said, yes. And that, yeah, the rest of it, it came naturally to me.
And that was probably a stroke of inspiration on your part, because being a Western, it led great for the building of the railroad. So,
yeah, it fit really well historically. And when I started doing the research on that region in the period I wanted to set it, you know, there were a lot of Chinese people in the area, so it just kind of, I mean, there's even a line in there, I think in like the second chapter, where one of the characters mentions we brought our monsters with us.
Okay. That's been a few weeks since I've read it. I know the guys here, I think they've flipped through it and been able to look through it, but I've read it twice so far. And
you really liked it that much?
I'm a sucker for Western horror, I guess. I don't know. Were you a fan of spaghetti westerns growing up? Because it seems like you drew from that as well.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I like to tell people that the whole series was just kind of a love letter to spaghetti westerns, to Shaw Brothers kung fu flicks, and you know, John Woo movies. So that was I thought that's what in my perfect universe, that's what would happen. A bunch of Hong Kong filmmakers would make spaghetti westerns full of monsters.
I'd probably pay to see that.
There you go.
Well, if you bought the book, you did. So there you go.
I didn't buy the book, so.
Oh, okay.
It was on loan from Richard.
Yeah. We're librarians. We check stuff out.
Oh, I understand.
I'm going to have to go back and pick up the miniseries. I saw that Ape Entertainment still has some individual issues still on stock. So.
Yeah, there are a few. I think the alternate covers of the first issue is still available, too.
And is that the one with the skeleton, or is that the one with the actual picture of the...
I think the alternate cover was actually the one with the zombies on it, but okay. I'm not entirely certain. I'm terrible about the marketing type stuff. Once I'm done creating them, they kind of released into the wild, and I stopped paying attention. So,
and just to get back with a spaghetti western theme, I don't remember there being too many horror westerns, except for a very few. Did you draw on those few when you were writing this? And do you remember those off the top of your head?
Well, the only one I can think of off the top of my head is Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. Okay. And it was a collaboration between the Shaw Brothers Studio of Hong Kong and Hammer Films from England.
Okay.
And it's funny. I'm technically not even sure how much of this story I'm legally allowed to tell. So I may actually have you edit this out later. I don't know. At okay. one point in time, I was asked to write a comic book sequel to Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Ah, okay.
And so, I mean, it was territory that I'd kind of mined before, but that story was so vastly different from what we ended up doing because it didn't have any Chinese vampires in it.
Okay.
So, I mean, it had some kind of like Chinese vampire monsters in it, but you know, they weren't the full on Chinese vampires that we see in the Wuxia cinema from Hong Kong. So, yeah, it wasn't quite the same thing. It wasn't anything I really could draw much inspiration from. But it was an area I'd played around in a little bit before. Another company ended up going with that license. And I didn't end up going to work for them. We couldn't come to terms on what to do. But there you have it.
I'm only familiar with a couple of them. Do you remember any, Matt? Come on now.
No.
Come on now. They're more Western than horror, but...
Yeah, I didn't really watch any.
No.
No.
And Clint Eastwood?
I do like Clint Eastwood, you know, and which brings up a question. Did you like movies like, you know, the Clint Eastwood movies? You know, Pale Rider, High Plains Drifter. Yeah, I can't think of any other off the top of my head.
And see, those are the two I thought of with the supernatural element to them.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Did any of those play, you know, into writing of this? Or, you know, were those movies you watched and...
For me, anyway, any time I write in a genre that there's a large body of film work already there, it tends to influence me somewhat. Even if it's just a question of absorbing mood and tone and texture and pacing. And yeah, I like Westerns in general, especially some of the... Well, Pale Rider is a really good one in particular. You know, all the Sergio Leone flicks that Eastwood did, you know, those are all fantastic. And I mean, you can tell that the individual covers of the series, they're all pastiches of existing movie posters for Westerns.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, it was something that the whole team had that going on in their heads.
They were going, yes, Westerns.
Yeah.
Have you been looking at any of the current Westerns coming out in graphic novel form and liking any
of those? Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the last DC titles I'm actually still reading is All-Star Western.
Okay.
Which is great fun. I've always liked the character of Jonah Hex. And that's there aren't many mainstream characters I'd be interested in writing. That's one of them. And I think it was... I might be wrong on this. I apologize if I am. I think it was Antarctic Press that just put out a series adapting Joe Lansdale's Crawling Sky. And it's kind of a horror Western science fiction kind of thing. They did, I think it was a 4-issue adaptation. And the artwork was really good and the tone was terrific. But It's Joe Lansdale. If anybody knows how to do a horror western, it's Joe Lansdale. Right. So
kind of I don't remember that one. I have to go back and look for that. Look
yeah,
that
it one. Just ended a couple months ago.
And Jonah Hex was another movie.
Yeah, you know, true.
Western. I hadn't even thought of that one until you mentioned it. But yeah, that is another horror western supernatural kind of thing. I forgot all about Jonah Hex. I guess because I didn't like the movie.
I don't think anybody liked the movie.
You know, my kid loved that movie.
Did he?
Oh, which child? He's Curtis.
Curtis?
Yeah, he was 11 years old when it came out, and he watched it nonstop. I got so sick of it.
I watched it and went, they could have done this so much better and just kind of kept going.
I mean, not every parent would let their kid watch that show, but it's not really all that bloody.
No, it's not that bad.
Nah.
But he can handle it.
Well, I look what April reads and Logan's has read, so.
Yeah.
Depends on the child and where they're at maturity-wise.
What do I read?
Well, you know what? Go ahead, sorry.
You can see how this podcast goes.
We're talking about you reading a little higher mature level than a lot of the kids when you were growing up.
I can read anything.
I know.
50 Shades of Grey.
Since fifth grade, I've been able to read anything.
No, I was mentioning, this is sort of off topic, but a bunch of horror movies these days are rated PG-13. And my wife had put that restriction on my kid. No rated R movie, so PG-13. Well, he came back saying that they watched Insidious.
Oops. When you were doing your research, you mentioned that. How much of your time did that entail researching Chinese mythology?
You know, I think I actually spent more time researching that area of the West in that decade, because the Chinese mythology thing was something I had already kind of done some research on. I already had some existing notes for that, so I had to spend a little more time on that part of Texas. But it's anytime I do a period piece, I do way more research than I need to.
Do more research than you need to, huh?
Oh, yeah, way more than I need to. And it's, I mean, even if it's stuff that's never going to make it onto the page, it helps me know what it just gives me a better sense of the period, gives me a better feel for it. I think makes it feel more realistic. I don't know. I don't know if the reader actually picks up on that, but it makes me feel better as a creator.
When you were writing the story, did Ape limit you to 3 issues, or could you have gone more?
When we first started talking about it, the idea was to do a series of miniseries.
Okay.
And but each miniseries had to kind of stand alone.
I was going to say, this kind of feels like the Star Wars. You're just kind of dropped right in the middle of the story.
Yeah, and you kind of are. And the very next series was actually supposed to be a prequel.
Okay.
And then we ultimately decided prequels suck. Let's not do that. So we're never going to bother doing the prequel.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. When's the prequel coming out?
Cause... Yeah, we're not going to bother. However, I have written the sequel. The art is finished for the sequel. I don't think it's been colored yet.
Okay.
But I don't have a release date. I tried very hard to get a release date before we did this. But, I wasn't able to pin the guys down on when exactly they thought it would be done.
Okay. Well, you definitely give me a shout out and let me know, and I'll put it on the blog for sure.
Oh, I will. Know. I will.
Especially when it's collected, for sure, so libraries can go back and pick it up. And because that's one of the things I was going to ask next is, it felt like you were dropped right in the middle in the intro. You definitely could tell that there's a complete story right there.
Yeah. So
kind of let my hopes kind of just shatter right there.
Yeah. Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, poor Richard.
Yeah, the prequel's never going to happen. In fact, there are a couple of characters that were going to be in the prequel that I've and were scheduled to die in the prequel. So now I've got these characters and I can use them in later sequels. So
there you go. That works out.
They could have died. You could have brought them back as vampires or a zombie.
That's
or something.
That's true.
See? Idea?
As you mentioned, or you had an artist with this one, you're an artist by trade as well.
Right.
How was that flipping the tables? How was that on you? Were you ready for that, or is that kind of a little bit of an unusual situation?
You know, it doesn't bother me. It's one of those things. I've done it enough times now, and really, I don't get so possessive of my scripts that I'm afraid of how the artist will interpret them. I know some writers that really bothers them. It doesn't bother me. If you have an artist who is a good, capable storyteller, they're going to bring something to the table, and they may see something on the page that you could not predict on the script. And if you don't let them run with that, if you don't let them explore that, you're a fool. And so, yeah, it actually helps me because we speak the same language. So I'm able to work with an artist whose style is completely different from my own. But we speak a common language, and it actually makes it a lot easier, especially with these period pieces, which are kind of tricky. So it actually was a good thing.
And you mentioned Ape, and I did as well. And right. Do you want to go into the story of that, or do you want to just skip over that and go to other stuff?
Oh, well, Ape Entertainment's an interesting thing because it's a company. I've had a long history with this company because I was one of the founding partners. And I didn't stay on with the company, not due to any hard feelings or anything like that. It turned out that the business of publishing was not something I was interested in doing. It really got in the way of my actually making comics.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't stay on on that end of the business, but I've been friends with these guys for years. So they call me and say, hey, you know, we're pursuing this particular license. Could you help us put together a series Bible for it? Or we want to do this mini series or this one shot. And so I write things for them. And it's ridiculous the amount of material I've written for that company that has never been published. They paid for it, so I can't complain.
Right.
You know? But, you know, just because, you know, they'll have an idea, they'll explore it, and they may go in another direction. But, yeah, so I continue working for them. They're good guys.
Do they... from what you've been involved with business, do they ever go back and revisit some of those old stories and maybe brush them off and pick them up and actually run, or is that kind of in
the closet? Eldorado was actually exactly one of those.
Okay.
The first draft of Eldorado, I think I wrote that in 2005, 2006.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we came back to it years later, just because we had started it with a different artist, and it was like pulling teeth to get usable pages out of this guy. He was very talented, and here's a little bit of advice for potential comic book artists out there. Do your frickin' research. Do your research. Put together reference files, and if you can't be bothered to do that, then don't ever take a gig doing a historical book, because you have no business drawing it. And every page was one of those things where we had to fight him on the, you know, you didn't reference this, you didn't reference that, this needs to be done like that, this needs to be done like this. And it was very arduous. And then he just vanished.
Okay.
And this, it happens sometimes. He was an international artist, and we lost track of him, and didn't hear from him for some time, so the series just kind of died off. And it was years later that Martin came along, and he was just perfect for it.
And if you don't get it right, the fans will definitely let you know.
Exactly. And the artwork on this thing on Eldorado has been, it's been universally acclaimed, and it absolutely should be, because he did a bang up job of it. And I threw some ridiculous stuff at the guy in that script, and he handled it all without batting an eye. And his research was meticulous.
Yeah, I loved her tongue.
Yeah.
How often do you hear that?
Well, depends on what kind of comics you read.
I guess so. True.
Never mind.
Oh, no comment?
I was going to make it.
Go ahead.
No.
Were you a little hesitant to bring out a genre book like this? Because, you know, there is some Westerns out there, but it's not a genre that's heavily ventured with the comic book medium.
You know, it's not. And this, I'm often told to not talk about this in interviews, but I kind of do anyway.
Well, we don't
have
to.
I'm not much of a superhero fan. I never have been. The comics I read as a kid tended to be monster comics and horror comics and things of that nature. And while I respect the superhero as a mythic archetype, and, you know, I respect the superhero in historical terms as far as what it's meant for comic books in America. I mean, I have to. I teach college courses on the subject, right, so I have to understand that. But, yeah, for me, that's never been something I really wanted to do. I tend not to think about market considerations when I'm writing something. It's basically a question of, I'm going to create this thing and hopefully talk some sucker into publishing it. And quite often that works out, and other times it does not. But yeah, so I wasn't really worried about it. And I thought, I mean, even though the Western itself is not a big deal right now, the mashup is. The idea of taking genres and cramming them together is. So even though there weren't a lot of Westerns, Western comics at the time, we thought, hey, you know, the mashup momentum is there. That's close enough to a genre.
Okay. And I know in today's marketplace, really, you shouldn't be scared about saying you're not comfortable with superheroes or don't enjoy them, because, I mean, look at a lot of the independents, Image particular. They're putting out a lot of different flavors of genres, so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only reason I get occasionally told not to mention it because some people think it sounds critical, you know, and it's not intended to sound critical of that genre at all, but, you know, there are those who are predisposed to hearing it that way.
Oh, I just wanted to see a Chinese vampire superhero.
There is one, and it was on the show Heroes.
Okay, I missed that one. We only watched the first season.
No,
did
you watch Heroes?
Like a lot of people, I watched the first season and abandoned it halfway.
You know what? It kind of. I have to admit, I watched all 5 seasons. Is there 5 or 4?
Something like
I don't
that.
Know. I watched them all. Hated the way it ended. But the dude that could travel through time.
Hero.
Yeah, he was.
He's not a vampire.
Well, but.
Nor a superhero.
He's a superhero, but he's not a vampire. But he is a Chinese superhero. So okay. You got two out
he's
of your
Japanese.
3 criteria.
He's Japanese, actually.
Oh, well, yeah. Fine. With split hairs here.
Very distinction there. There's
well, you're
kind of
splitting nationality, actually. Yeah. That's a pretty
but
big hair.
But I did
hair.
Forget that they were Chinese, not Japanese. I was thinking they were Japanese for some reason. Eh, my bad. Hey, it's been a while since I watched Heroes, okay?
So when the comics you were reading when you were growing up, were they the Marvel stuff, like the Swamp Thing, or were they like creepy? Or
I read a lot of the Warren comics, a lot of the creepy, eerie Vampirella. I mean, with Marvel, I read the Man-Thing. With DC, I read Swamp Thing. The closest thing to a superhero I really loved when I was a kid was the Hulk. And that's basically an atomic monster comic disguised as a superhero comic occasionally.
Pretty much.
So, yeah, it was that was the stuff I grew up on. I mean, and like everybody else, too. I mean, you know, you make an exception for Batman. Everybody makes an exception for Batman. But, yeah, other than that, yeah, it's always been monsters for me.
Okay. See, I have a mixed. It's just whatever I like, that's what I like. So.
Sure.
Would you remind you?
Main character of Darker Than Black in season 1 has been likened to a Chinese electric Batman, so there's another Chinese superhero.
True. Do you read much manga at all, Mike? Or
you know, it's funny. I kind of have to, because just from a collection development perspective, and I like to be able to do informed reader's advisory when it comes to the manga. It's not a style that I discovered on my own, organically. It was one of those things that I was aware of as a scholar that I then had to study. It's nothing I ever stumbled across. That said, I'm a sucker for Astro Boy. I think that's still probably the best Japanese comic ever done. Just it's such a rich breadth of emotional texture that Tezuka is able to cram into what's basically a very simple strip. That's impressive stuff to me.
Have to ask you then, have you read Pluto then?
I have not read that one.
Oh, that one has Astro Boy in it. It's a pretty good story. It's pretty good.
Well, I want to know if you watched.
One. There's so much of that stuff. I've got a lot of catching up to do.
Well, I want to know if you watched Star Blazers when you were younger too.
Oh, yeah. And like a lot of people, I had no idea that what I was watching was from Japan.
True.
Same with G-Force, or Battle for the Planets, or whatever they called it in whichever year you discovered it as a child.
That was my, well, Speed Racer was my first exposure.
Oh, okay.
That I didn't realize. And then I watched Battle of the Planets, then did Star Blazers, but I was pretty much out of watching cartoons when Robotech came along.
God, you guys make me feel young. Oh. Because, no, I didn't get into anime,
Chris,
until Dragon Ball Z. And they sort of Americanized it with their English dubbing.
Yeah.
But, God, I loved that show. I watched it from Dragon Ball all the way to GT.
Good grief.
That's dedication.
How many hours of your life that was?
Yes.
I was in college, so I had plenty.
Oh, okay. There you
go. Hey, Mark, come on in.
Come across, Michael.
We got another Michael joining us here.
Oh, okay.
With you being with, you're kind of in both fields, librarianship and the comic industry, we want to concentrate on the comic industry right now, okay, and then we'll get into the librarianship because I want to get back to what you were mentioning earlier about the readers' advisories. Where do you see that a lot of people are being doomsayers about this format of storytelling? I'm kind of in between, but what are your thoughts as being, you have your toes in that industry, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts, quite simply, are the doomsayers are not paying attention. There are so many new venues for comics that this medium is not going anywhere. You've got, I mean, print obviously is going to lose some of its supremacy, but it doesn't mean it's going away entirely. Because how many of us are devoted to that tactile experience as part of our reading experience? You know, how many of us, part of reading comics is collecting comics, is owning comics, is being able to appreciate them as a physical object, not just as a comic book. That's not going to change. But then there are plenty of readers who there are series that they don't feel the need to own in that fashion, and that they read digitally. And I think it's going to be one of those things to where people have comics that they buy for their bookshelf, and then people have comics that they keep up with digitally. The pricing platform is going to continue to evolve, but comics aren't going anywhere as a serialized medium. They lend themselves too well to it, and they've been doing so for going on a century now. It's not going to change anytime soon.
And you've kind of dabbled in both. You have web comics as well as...
Absolutely. I did a series for Viper that was a digital exclusive. And and they were actually launching a few series at that time that were digital exclusives. And we didn't have any difficulty getting people who were new to comics to turn on to this idea of you can read this on your smartphone. So even if you've got an established readership that doesn't like that technology, there's this entire population out there who is comfortable with the idea of experiencing comics that way for the first time. So, yeah, I think there's plenty of room for both delivery systems.
And you mentioned that series, it's Hooligan?
Yeah,
it was Hooligan. I love it, so. And you are currently, you mentioned, working on the sequel to the El Dorado. Is there anything else you're working on that you can mention, or just you got different...
A few things, actually. I'm doing a couple more of those library instructional comics. I'm juggling a couple of them right now, which is a lot of fun because I will literally draw a page for one, and then I will jump over to the other book and draw a page for it, just so that both clients have things coming into them steadily.
Okay.
And I sent you the cover to one of them, actually.
And you also sent me an actual issue as well.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So I've got a couple of those going on right now. I wrote an information literacy graphic novel textbook for the University of Chicago with Matt Epson, my collaborator on some of these library comics. And I was originally scheduled to draw that too, but it's literally going to take about a year, and I simply don't have the time to be able to sit down and spend a year drawing this one book.
Okay.
So, yeah, someone else will end up drawing that.
I'll have to contact him when he gets that one released. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Logan, did you have a question?
You already passed the subject I was going to comment on.
That's all right.
Three subjects ago.
We can go back. It's fine.
Yeah, it can all be edited.
The switch between digital and comic. I will probably not pay for any web comic type thing, but I will if I find the actual books to it at Hastings or something, buy the books to it.
So you're
even though I've already read it online. I
don't know. I kind of think it depends on the user, because for me it's just easier to carry this around than it is to carry a handful of manga around.
But it's one of those he likes. He doesn't mind reading it on there, but you like having the physical.
Well,
yeah. And if you're like April, you have to have something tangible. Or well, it's
the
not
other
worth
thing,
it.
The other thing is if I buy a book and then it's not any good, it's just going to sit on my shelf or I'm going to get rid of it. And that's money wasted. Especially if your books are 15, 20 bucks a piece.
It's money.
It just kind of depends on the user.
It's money going to the people to get them to make more books.
Is that how that works, Michael? Go.
Well, yeah. As one of the people that make those books, we thank you for that mindset. it is true, though. I mean, sometimes you're doing what you're voting with your dollar. You know, you're making sure that even if this book isn't necessarily my thing, I want to make sure that this sort of thing continues to happen. So sometimes you do that. I admit doing it myself occasionally.
Well, if you charge for digital content, I mean, the production of it's almost free.
Yeah, I mean, other than actually producing the pages, you know, paying your writer, paying your letterer, paying the artist, paying the, you know, the coloring, and if you have to do any kind of digital packaging,
and
that can be surprisingly expensive sometimes.
A lot of companies,
and a real pain in the ass, but
yeah, a lot of companies charge the same price for the digital material as they do for the tangible material.
Right, and I personally think they'd be a lot smarter if they didn't do that. If they charge less for the digital and use the digital as a way to tempt you into buying the print, you know, or buying the collection later down the line, I think there's some potential there.
Well, I checked out. I became an Audible member just so I could listen to our last comic pop book.
Bascula Station.
Yeah, it was free, but all its sequels, and then there's like 12 or 13 books they charge you for.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great idea.
It's one of those, come down my alley here. I got some crack for you.
No. First dose is free, baby.
Yeah. I'm tempting you with the carrot.
True. And in a sense, it's almost what it's like for a collector. Right?
It is. We're all junkies. We can pretend otherwise, but we are what we are.
And then life gets in the way.
I'm a major collector. I've spent too much money, and hopefully my kids will reap the benefits if they ever sell any of my stuff. I think at last count I had over 10,000 individual issues.
Oh, good grief.
And over 2,000 action figures and stuff.
He's addicted. It's his crack.
Yes, it is.
That sounded bad. Sorry.
It did. It's all right. Take it for how you want it.
So what do you read now, Mike? Is it still the horror comics that you gravitate to?
I like a lot of horror comics, but I also really like science fiction. The majority of what I read these days in terms of pure page count, I read a lot of European comics. Particularly French comics, Belgian comics, comics from that part of the world. I'm really into that stuff. Particularly, I've been reading a lot of things written by Xavier Dorisson. And yeah, it's good stuff, and they do genres that appeal to me, but aren't necessarily the bigger genres here. You know, science fiction, horror, things like that. So I mean, page wise, I'm reading a lot more of that. But as far as titles that you know anybody has frickin' heard of, I'm reading Swamp Thing, and I'm still enjoying Swamp Thing considerably. I'll probably always read Swamp Thing. That'll be the one mainstream title I will never stop reading. I'm reading All-Star Western, like I said. I'll follow Gail Simone just about anywhere. Her characters all have such lively voices that I would really miss not hearing those people anymore. Okay. So, yeah, now that she's writing Red Sonja, I'm happier than a pig in mud. It's fantastic. I'm reading Lazarus. I don't know. Anybody in the room reading Lazarus?
I missed that one. I'm gonna have to read it in a collected edition.
It's fantastic. That first issue might have been the most flawless first issue I've read in years in terms of just doing a phenomenal job of setting up a very complex bit of world building, introducing all the characters, but not feeling expository. I mean, there was actual movement to the story too. It was like a master class in how to do a first issue.
That's what I've been hearing from everybody, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to pay a pretty penny if I want the individual first issue.
Yeah, that's one of those series that's definitely going to get a nice hardcover down the line. So,
and before we wrap up here, would you mind doing a bumper for us?
What do you need me to do for a bumper?
Basically, just say this is C. Michael Hall, writer and creator of Hell Dorado, and you are listening to Comic Pop Library.
Okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah. Let me. Actually make a note of that to myself before I screw that up.
We have a bunch of musicians, but it'd be kind of cool to have some writers in there too, and artists.
What'd you say, Logan?
I remember the one who has said that already is my dad, not the actual.
True.
That is true. Sorry.
Don't worry there, Michael. Richard could only do that because he has it written down on the piece of paper in front of him. Otherwise, he'd screwed it up. And trust me, I've seen him do it many times.
Try to be prepared after so many screw ups.
How many intros have we had to redo?
True.
Okay, and how do you exactly want the name of the show read?
Comic Pop Library.
All right. Well, let me see if I can do this without completely cocking it up. I'm not a professional broadcaster. It's not in my skill set. So.
We aren't either.
You're ready.
Okay, we got it in 3, 2, 1.
This is C. Michael Hall, writer and creator of Ape Entertainment's Hell Dorado, and you're listening to Comic Pop Library.
Ta-da!
Take one.
Yay. You sounded professional to me.
Really? You're going to have to go down to your radio station.
I did a radio commercial for our library, and everybody's like, "Wow, you should do that professionally." I'm like, "I know, I don't want to look at me either."
I was actually saying you actually have that radio kind of voice.
Yeah,
that, you know, you could.
I've heard that for years. I can't do it all that spontaneously. I don't know that I could be entertaining on a drive time show. Yeah,
get somebody like April to bounce stuff off of and. It could be pretty lively.
Oh, she's going to talk.
What?
Don't worry about it.
What?
Huh? Well, this last part, I want to get into more of the side that we are in as librarians, and you are actually a librarian as well. The first thing I want to ask and have you comment about, I know you've done this for the Kansas Library Conferences for several years, but for people that are unfamiliar that might be listening to this, you mentioned it already, but the educational library guideline comic books that you've been creating with Matt Epson, can you expand on that and let people know what that's about?
Well, I mean, the short form of the story is that I was assistant librarian working under Matt at McPherson College a few years ago, and we were surprised and unprepared by the number of incoming freshmen that had no library skills. It's not that these kids were defective or unintelligent in any way, shape, or form. They just had not grown up having the same library experiences that we'd had growing up. So we found that we spent a ridiculous amount of our time helping with just basic routine skills that there were much more efficient ways to teach. And you know, every time you go out and do a class at an academic library, from an academic library, where you go around campus and teach a class on info lit, you find your handouts all over campus later in trash cans or just discarded. So we wanted to be able to teach these basic information literacy skills and create a handout that people would not throw away. And the idea occurred to us, let's do it as a comic book. And it became this worldwide viral sensation, which we completely did not expect. But we're pretty excited about, because then other libraries started contacting us about creating similar books customized for their library. And so Matt and I have done a couple of those together. I'm working on a couple of them by myself right now.
I think you have three actually out there, or four that's actually out there.
There are four if you count the one we did for Emporia State University's MLS program.
Okay.
But that wasn't so much an instructional one as more of a... I don't want to call it a marketing tool, because it was less a marketing tool and more of a this is what librarians do, and this is how your existing education can be funneled into this master's program.
Okay.
So it wasn't quite a market, you know, as it wasn't as grossly commercial as most marketing tools are. So I don't like to call it, describe it as such, but yeah. So there are the four of them, if you count all of those.
And you gave me a sneak peek of one you're working on. We won't mention what it is, but it looks like to be another cool one.
That one's going to be fun. That one's going to be a lot of fun. And the theme of that one is pirates. You know, each of these has kind of a theme. And yeah, so this one's got pirates. And another one that I'm doing for a different library has 1950s style Martian invaders.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So these
Mars attacks.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
That was.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask him when he said pirates if they were Chinese vampiric pirates.
No. Although there are some ghost pirates in there, which is about as Scooby-Doo as you can possibly get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some Scooby-Doo jokes in the book, too, specifically for that purpose. But.
There's a series called Vampirates, so you might be able to look for Chinese ones
Vampirates,
there.
Huh?
Yeah, there's a book series called Vampirates.
Yeah.
So you might be able to look for some Chinese ones there.
You're in that vampire Chinese kick.
It's a unique idea. I think it's awesome.
There you go, Michael.
All right. There you go.
Really noted.
It's unique.
And one of the other things with you actually are in a working library now.
Right.
And you're an advocate for graphic novels.
Absolutely.
And I enjoy being an advocate as well as whenever I can. But how do you see, I know how I see it, and several people have heard my views, but just to come from a different perspective, where do you see graphic novels within the library, and does it help, or is it a negative influence?
Our graphic novel circulation statistics are absolutely insane. There's the only collection in our library that circulates faster and more frenziedly than our graphic novels is our DVD collection, because there's no video store in this town.
Okay.
So, I mean, that gives you an idea of the kind of numbers they're doing when they can compete with a collection that has taken the place of the local Blockbuster. So, they're a huge presence in our library. They engage multiple age groups. They engage people with multiple interests. They engage people... they engage people who wouldn't otherwise be reading, but at the same time, they also engage people who are avid readers of traditional prose and enjoy the visual narrative as well. So I can't even really think of a negative in terms of having graphic novels in the library. I mean, if you need the academic research to demonstrate that they're a great thing to have so that you can increase the number of literacy modalities you can encounter, you know, to use academic language, you know, and they're a good way of, in the right hands, they're a good way of even couching complex social issues.
Right.
And, you know, if you don't believe that, then apparently you haven't been paying attention to the history of the American political cartoon since 1828.
True.
So, you know, there's a lot to it there. And, yeah, I don't think there are any negatives. I think every library that can afford them should absolutely carry them.
And I'm in a smaller community, so I kind of have to watch some of the adult titles to not go too far. And I advocate for larger libraries, definitely, mm-hmm. you know, create the adult collection and work with it. And sometimes it feels like a censorship type deal, but it's one of those I say, know your community.
Very much so. And it's also one of those things, too, to where if you're going to develop your collection towards an adult collection, you kind of have to understand that historically, in the United States, comics were dismissed for decades as kid stuff. And were really, really, people didn't start getting past that idea until the 80s. And they're just now starting to get past that idea at the mainstream level. So there are still, I hate to say it this way, but I can't come up with a more eloquent way to put it. There are some generational issues you have to overcome there when it comes to the perception of what comics are supposed to be and who they're for. You have to kind of be prepared to debate that topic and to debate it in a manner that is non-confrontational, but intelligent and informed, and at the same time explain to them, this is the 21st century. This is what comics do. There are comics for everybody, regardless of what they want. You know, it's out there.
And I have to say, one of my experiences is hilarious to a degree, but I started focusing on the Japanese manga at conference, and we were talking about fan service. because I don't want to have any illusions. I want people to know what's in there.
Yep.
And after showing that slide and explaining it, this lady just jumped up and says, if I have any of those in my library, I'd delete them, and any of you guys that have them in yours are going straight to hell. And she walked out of the room, and we just kind of looked and went, okay, and next we have...
there's really no way you could have engaged her in intelligent discourse. I don't think that was ever going to happen then.
I would have loved to have seen that.
Me too.
It was interesting.
There are pitfalls to developing an adult collection, especially in smaller communities where, you know, you've got a larger percentage of your target demographic doesn't understand where comics have gone since the 1980s. But this is a pretty small town that I'm in. You know, our library, we have a nice library, you know, and we've won major awards, but, you know, it's still, we serve a patron population of around 13,000.
Okay.
That's and pretty good size. About 10,000 locals and about 3,000 more in the surrounding communities. And we haven't run into a lot of trouble, but I'm actually giving a presentation on graphic novel collection development this year's KLA. And I talk about avoiding some of these pitfalls or how to engage in this dialogue without stepping into a bear trap.
And we definitely want to get with you and have you visit with us again when we're there, because Chris and I will be there, and so will April. She might actually talk that time.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't get to
go. It's been kind of nice, actually.
No, April. She'll get us back, though.
No comment from the peanut gallery, but I won't get to go. Boss said I couldn't go.
Yeah, Matt's got to stay home.
I got to man the fort.
He's been leashed.
Yeah, somebody's got to keep the home fire burning.
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll about wrap it up. If you can, like I said, if you want to take a short break, we can log off and take about a 15 minute break, and then we could connect with you again and discuss El Dorado in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, sure, works for me.
So that way we'll just let everybody be able to hang up and get a nice 15-minute quick break. But
yeah, it works for me. My wife's out of town, and I have more beer.
Ah, there we go.
Sweet.
But we appreciate you taking the time for the visit here today, Michael. And
you bet.
Thank you, and enjoyed it.
All right. Well, talk to you again in a bit.
All righty. Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.